like D&D fuels their imagination and makes them feel special, while drawing them deeper and deeper into the bowels of El Diablo. Observe the previously unobservable.
I'm attacking the darkness!
Roll the dice to see if I'm getting drunk!
Yeah, you are!
Are there any girls there?
Yeah!
Anyone can play.
I don't really know the rules.
Listen, there aren't any rules. It's a game of the imagination.
Oh, okay.
This is your character sheet. Your name is Titania.
I don't know what any of this stuff means.
I'll help you.
I'm the Dungeon Master. I control worlds, universes.
Okay, you guys can talk to each other now if you want.
Welcome to episode 25 of DC RPG, the Hero Points Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Game Master Siskoid.
And I'm the irredeemable player, Shag. In addition to being an episode of Hero Points, this isn't also an episode of JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. Now, specifically, this is another of our spotlight episodes where we look at something outside of the monthly JSA comics.
Yes, today we're covering a source book for the DC Heroes RPG, starring a plethora of characters from the World War II era of DC Comics called The World at War. This is a source book for use with the second edition DC Heroes RPG released in 1991. So in addition to Sergeant Rock and the Haunted Tank, G.I. Robot, the Blackhawks, and many other wartime soldiers, this massive 128-page book also features information on the Golden Age era, JSA, the All-Star Squadron, the Freedom Fighters, the Young All-Stars, not so woo, and many other DC superheroes of World War II, which makes this a perfect crossover between our two podcasts, or, you know. And it's, you know, Shag, it's one of the most requested things that DC Heroes RPG put out. You know, listeners have asked us to cover.
Well, the interesting thing is, all right, so if we were to go back in time to, oh my gosh, I don't know, 2015 or something, when the Hero Points podcast started, I had this vision of doing a monthly role-playing game podcast, which fell apart entirely because it was on my shoulders, which is a bad idea. And I invited you to join me. I think that was your first podcasting ever, if I remember correctly, right?
I might have shown up on, you know, like Secret Origins or...
Okay, or something. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But it was the first time where you were hosting something.
Correct.
You know, like, yeah, okay. And at the time, there were basically three things we wanted to cover. We wanted to cover the first edition or second edition box sets because we loved them so much. Then we wanted to cover the DC Universe Atlas, which we loved so much and we did. And this was the other thing. So it took us 10 years to get to it, I think.
I have been beating off, I'm sorry about that expression, I've been beating off potential guests who have been suggesting that they do it.
Oh.
And I've been like making excuses. No, we, you know, Shag and I are doing that one together and it's going to be a JSA thing. So I've been holding the barbarians at the gates.
Well, I appreciate that. So if folks, just a little bit of history on this, I used to run a podcast called the Justice League International, Bwahaha Podcast, ran for 8.5 years. And somewhere in there along the lines in that period, Siskoid and I decided to team up every year for, I guess, 3 years straight, covering a different JLI, a role-playing supplement for the game. And so this just fit perfectly in here for us to cover this one as part of my JSA show. And by the way, Siskoid, I don't know if you thought about this, but there is another JSA sourcebook we could cover next year for the West End Games version.
I'm aware it exists.
Oh my God, it's so good. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about the DC Heroes, The World at War. And I love this book, and I think you love this book too.
Yes, it's one that I have read cover to cover in the past. You don't do that a lot with RPG source books. You know, sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. Am I going to use this? Am I not going to use this? But sometimes the subject matter is just too much fun.
Yeah.
And you just like plow through it like it's a regular book and not something that you reference.
It's fantastic. It really is. And we're going to get in this. We're going to dive into this, folks. But yeah, it's celebrating the wartime characters, you know, the Sergeant Rocks of the world. It's celebrating the JSA. It's the whole package. And probably my favorite thing about it is that it is a snapshot of what these heroes and characters look like in 1943. So rather than, you know, the geriatric JSA that we're talking about in JSA in the 90s, this, as published in the 90s, talks about them in their prime, how they were in 1943. You get their stats like they were in 1943. It's not talking about the future problems they have or who died and who didn't. It just focuses in that era. So it's a really fascinating snapshot of what the post-crisis DC universe looked like for World War II. I love it.
So as usual, we're here to celebrate DC RPGs or RPGs in general on Let's Roll. But the mission statement is that we are tapping into nostalgia. Ours and yours. So we're not going to get into the technical aspects too much. You know, we think that's a little dry and it's for other podcasts to do that. We are for the lapsed gamer. We are for the comic book reader first.
That's fair, because I mean, a lot of these people are listening on the JSA feed,
right?
And they don't care about role-playing books. So we're not going to say, well, you know, if you have a 4 versus a 5 in the statistics and you're rolling 20-sided die, I mean, no, we're not doing that.
I probably only have one note that's about a stat number.
I've got a couple, but it's not going to get bogged down boring.
No. We're not going to spend too much time on that. Of course, there are spoilers for players in a way. You know, we might mention things. I don't know. Are you really in a World War II DC Heroes campaign right now? Maybe you will be after this, because we're going to polish this Jeep. And finally, well, there's a reason for why this is coming out on November 11th. If you're in a country that's part of the British Commonwealth, here, it's Remembrance Day, our version of the American Memorial Day, if you like, observed on this date. On the date that marked the end of the First World War, a commemoration of the service members lost, lest we forget. And we forget often, unfortunately. There have been other wars, and Remembrance Day remembers the people lost in them as well. You know, it fell on a Tuesday. That's my day for my shows. So Shag was kind enough to play ball on this and have this show come out on November 11th.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, normally I release the JSA shows on Sundays. But yeah, it makes perfect sense. Because you mentioned all those things in those countries. And if you're in the United States, you would know November 11th, of course, as Veterans Day, which is a holiday here in the U.S. that honors those who served in the United States Armed Forces. And we appreciate their service. Made perfect sense to delay the Sunday release for Tuesday. Absolutely. Now, folks, before we get too far into this book and our excitement, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. This episode of JSA in the 90s and Hero Points is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 55% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library. Usually it's tied into our discussion in some way, shape, or form. I picked Crisis on Multiple Earths Trade Paperback, Book 3, Countdown to Crisis. Now, this has got a whole bunch of the different JLA, JSA crossovers in there. In my opinion, it's got the best ones in there. It's the George Perez era. But specifically, I am mentioning this because it's got Crisis on Earth Prime, which is a crossover between the JLA, the JSA, and All-Star Squadron. And it took place during World War II, so it seems like the perfect synergy of things to have on this episode. As you look at the breadth of the trade, it is, of course, written by a number of people, including Jerry Conway, George Perez, Marv Wolfman, and others. Art by Dick Dillon, George Perez, Rick Buckler, Don Heck, and others. Cover art is by Kevin Nolan. It's 472 pages, which is crazy. 472 pages, full color, soft cover. I mean, that's like half the size of one of those giant omnibuses. Normally retails for $39.99, but you can get it 40% off right now in stock trade, so it's only $23.99, which is a heck of a steal. Siskoy, what did you bring, sir?
Well, I'm going to tell you right now, Jack, there's an absolute and tragic dearth of DC War Comics collections in print right now.
You are correct.
Absolutely horrendous. So I went with the superhero side of things, just like you did, and not even a comic, but a reference guide to some of the heroes in the book we're covering, but also many that aren't. So a companion of sorts. It's the Quality Companion softcover from Tomorrow's Publishing. It provides the first dedicated look at that golden age publisher, Quality Comics, which spawned all of the Freedom Fighters, but a lot of Plastic Man, Blackhawks, that was all Quality Comics, which are now under the DC Comics umbrella. I've had this. I've read this. It really goes into the weeds. I quite like it. So you can get it here. There's a cover by Dick Giordano on this. Obviously, it's written by Jim Amash and Mike Kuiman. It's 256 pages. It was $31.95, 20% off at InStock Trades, so it's now $23.99. I recommend it.
That's fantastic. Tomorrow's puts out amazing books, right? I mean, and this is a perfect niche sort of thing for them to dig into. I'm sure it's amazing. I've heard other people say it's wonderful as well. So that is awesome. So look for both of these folks on InStock Trades for all your other trade paperback needs. Now, folks, we do need to also take a second to thank our supporters on Patreon, because this episode is sponsored in part with their assistance.
Yes, if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FW podcasts to leave a one-time or a monthly donation. It helps us host all of this content that you apparently crave. All of these shows on this entire network. It's a lot of content. It's heavy. It costs money, and that's exactly what we do with your support.
And at certain tiers, if you support us on Patreon, you'll be mentioned on the show of your choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on Justice Society Presents or the Let's Roll podcast. Our thanks go out to these all-star squadron of supporters: Alex Osias, Al the Comics Guy, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, Chris Mort, Craig Fletcher, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Ducky, Extremely Uncanny, Gord Tolton, Jason Keane, Jay Campbell, Keechee Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Matt Ev, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Acheson, Mike Zamkowski, Roger Priebe, Russell Burbage, Symbol Pending, Ted Kilvington, and Tim Price. Keep them flying, boys. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast.
Buy podcast bonds.
Exactly right.
And of course, you can join the conversation, our website, where you can leave comments on the show post at fireandwaterpodcast.com. And of course, you'll find us also on social media.
Like on Facebook, you can find us as Fire and Water Podcast Network or JSA Presents. Same thing with Blue Sky and Instagram, because if you may not be aware, but Fire and Water Podcast has its own Instagram now as well, or of course, JSA Presents.
Okay. Well, let's look at this thing.
Yay! 10 years in the making!
We'll prepare a little gallery post on fireandwaterpodcast.com just to show you what it looks like in there.
I'm just saying, if the stats for the Red Bee are not out there, we will riot. I'm just saying.
All right. I'll take that under advisement. I'm also a big fan of the Red Bee, okay? So that's not a problem. The cover here is by Cary Gamble, Tom Palmer, and Bob LaRose. It's interesting because it's Sergeant Rock in the trenches, looking at an American Life magazine, and the magazine has a color picture of the All-Star Squadron, or certain members of it, because I don't think they would fit in just one picture.
Right.
America's Homefront Heroes, dated November 1944, so that gives us a snapshot at when this is for him, anyways. Not an action cover, but a super interesting way to juxtapose the Homefront Heroes, which are superheroes, mystery men, and then, you know, normal soldiers from war comics, which are also covered in this book, but don't usually mix it up with the superheroes.
Exactly. It's the perfect way to show both. Because you hear about it all the time, why didn't the costume heroes go over to the trenches and fight and all that kind of thing? So this is a great way to showcase both. A few other things to note, like he is actually in a trench that they've clearly have probably dug out.
Yep.
And he's got like a giant mail sack next to him, so it obviously just came from home. And one thing I want to mention is across the top, the actual logo, you get the World at War, but it says The World At in sort of a cute, just smaller font. It's got like Earth, and the Earth has wings, like military ranking sort of wings. But then it's got War in giant letters that take up basically like the whole top third of the cover and actually bleed off the edges. It's supposed to sort of echo a lot of those major newspaper headlines you'd see when war strikes. I mean, I remember when the Iraq War started, my hometown paper had a giant headline just like this. It took up the entire top half of the fold. It said War. So this was a thing that newspapers would do back then. And so it's sort of echoing that. I just think it's a really effective way to communicate everything on the cover.
When you announced this on social media that we were going to cover this, somebody sent us a sketch of the alternate cover.
That someone was John Joshua, by the way. Thank you, John.
On Blue Sky. Yes. Very cool. I think maybe it's a little bit Hitler forward.
Well, you want to describe it real quick?
Right. This one is split. It's a little bit like Flash of Two Worlds, you know, one of those, or a lot of the early DC Comics Presents where the splash page was cut in two. And on one side, you have superheroes, and on the other side, you have wartime heroes. So the superhero ones, you've got the All-Star Squadron is running towards Baron Blitzkrieg. And on the other side, you have probably Sergeant Rock and Easy Company shooting at a tank, which is in the foreground coming towards them. So, and then in the middle, which would have been under the title, is Hitler's face grinning as he looks down on these events. So that's what I mean. It's a little bit Hitler forward.
Yeah, it's a little too much Hitler, but otherwise it would have been a great striking cover. I think the final cover works better, even though it's quieter and less action-oriented. Yeah. I think it sells the whole picture better. But the other one, I mean, Cary Gamble can't draw a bad page. So, I mean, it looks great. And even if it's just a rough sketch, it looks phenomenal and would have been an interesting cover. But yeah, I think Hitler Forward's probably a little too Hitler Forward is the right phrase. I don't know that those words have ever been put together in that way. And I don't know that they ever should again.
So especially since the forces of the Axis are in the foreground and bigger in the action bits as well. Oh, you know, they're
good point. Yeah.
They're showing their backs, but they're bigger. So this was a little too Nazi, perhaps. So I'm glad they went with what they went with, but both covers are interesting.
All right, so let's crack open this 128-page tome. The credits page, it says, is released in 1991, written by Ray Wininger, who wrote a lot of the DC Heroes material, with credit to editors Jack A. Barker, Jim Muser, and A. Margaret Goetz. It does credit Research and Hitler's Bunker, created by Rob McLees. I don't know if I'd want that credit in the book myself, but anyway. With shout-outs to Bob Kaniger and Chris Kubesik. And then interior art is credited to DC staff, which means it was just taken from various DC comics at different points.
Right.
So, why don't you start us off on the... Oh, sorry, we're not even in chapter one. We're in the introduction.
There's an introduction, a single page, A World at War, and it just explains the nature of the source book and sets expectations.
I do like the sidebar where it tells you, like, you know, in New York, and it's telling you something that's happened. It's almost like story hooks.
Yeah, in Sicily, in Berlin. So you have all these different theaters, and it's supposed to spark your imagination. It's like, oh, look at this source book. I could go to different places, start different campaigns all over the world. So in chapter one, the Second World War, this is really 25 pages of history, all the actions taken during World War II, mostly based upon real world World War II events with a little bit of comic book history thrown in. They say here, this is an interesting bit, because they say it's an excerpt from the Metropolis Daily Planet Encyclopedia. And they made me look. Was this a thing?
Oh my gosh.
It is not a thing. But it's still strange that it exists in the DCU, isn't it? It's like the Daily Planet put out an encyclopedia?
Instead of Encyclopedia Britannica, you have Encyclopedia Metropolis Daily Planet.
I don't know. Maybe some newspapers have done that in the past. I'm not aware, but it's an odd thing for them to publish. But really, you know, this is a pretty good history of World War II, in brief, that I think anyone could use to roleplay in the era, you know, regardless of whether you use superheroes or not. Because I do own a number of source books in the GURPS World War II line, which go into more depth. But I might start here, you know, pick a theater of war, then go reference them in GURPS or in actual history books, which I do have. I did for a while receive as a kid the Time Life World War II series.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
So, and I read those recently. There's a lot of them I didn't read. I was only interested in The Secret War, which was the one that they advertised on TV, which is all about spies. And then they kept coming, and I didn't tell my mom to stop, but I wasn't really reading them. But having read them, and looking at this, it's like, oh, yeah, there's a similar, let's pick a theater, let's just look at that theater. Of course, it's adjusted for the DCU here. So you'll spot, you know, there's references to Markovia, which is one of the allies, or Brother Blood's Zandia. It's in the Axis. It's unfortunately not in the maps. They've included maps where, like, you know, like troop movement and that kind of stuff. The fake countries aren't on those maps. Oops.
Well, I want to say about the history, you said in brief, I mean, the history is like 20 pages of reading. There's like a 5-page timeline. So if you look at like the 20-page history, I found that absolutely fascinating. Because, I mean, we learned about World War II in high school and, you know, in college classes, but they didn't teach us very much. Like, I honestly, I'm embarrassed to say I learned more from this book than I think probably learned in class.
Definitely.
And you talked about all the DC stuff's been mixed in. Maybe I'm underselling it, but again, exclude the timeline. So you just say there's 20 pages, just history on the war, which I found fascinating. I'd say only about 10% of it is DC Comics continuity. Most of it is just facts.
Right. You got to mention that the superheroes can't go to Europe or because of the, you know, the Spear of Destiny and stuff like that. You got to mention stuff like that. But otherwise, the war went as the war went.
Yeah.
I mean, there's one crazy theory in here that... I wanted to mention, they advanced the idea that the first wave of metagene mutations in the Golden Age was because there's a moral balance that evolves villains for every hero that's triggered and vice versa. Like the metagene has a moral component.
Well, yeah, because they said there's more heroes than villains at first in World War II. Then this metagene thing compensates by making more villains as you get into like the 50s or whatever.
Right.
Totally bizarre. It sounds like a Roy Thomas idea to me. I don't know.
Evil energies that probably also caused the war or exacerbated the war. You know, it's kind of Lords of Chaos and Order, or, you know, there's some sort of mystical force of morality at work, and that triggers the metagene. It's in there if you want to use it as an excuse for having superpowers during World War II.
I'm sure somebody at home knows exactly where it was first cited in DC Special L42 or whatever. So
it just felt to me like it was an invention of this source book because I've never heard of it.
Could have been. All right, well, ready to go to chapter two? Action on the home front. So this one's 14 pages. So this outlines special rules for creating your own new Golden Age hero. So if you want to insert yourself into the All-Star Squadron or the Freedom Fighters or maybe Young All-Stars because you have self-image problems, I don't know, whatever.
You made a young hero.
Right. By the way, all kidding aside, I absolutely love the Young All-Stars in concept. I love some of those first few issues. It just wasn't my favorite book as it went on. But anyway, but it also is just a fun punching bag.
I think the reason you would use the Young All-Stars as your group in the game is because you would want like brand new, fresh heroes, let's say your own heroes. And what the one thing that they did that others didn't do is that they went on the sort of USO tour, selling war bonds and, you know, getting goodwill for the war effort. So if that's your hook into a campaign where, okay, well, we were going to be moving around the country, maybe to the war front to do the USO stuff, find adventure everywhere. Well, the Young All-Stars is your team.
Well, and you know what? And this is none of this is in the book where I'm off the reservation here. But, you know, what you could do, too. I mean, Young All-Stars just means that you're a young person and in the All-Star Squadron.
Yeah.
Your group could form a whole entirely independent group of Young All-Stars. Who's to say there's not five or six groups of Young All-Stars out there doing things? So you don't have to be beholden to those five, you know, or six characters that were created for the comics. Either way. So this chapter tells you how to create your own Golden Age hero. It includes some new advantages that you can use, which are things that help your character, give you a little bit of perks. It includes gadget rules for building Golden Age gadgets. It gives you some background on various superhero groups that we're going to talk about a little bit, that we're operating in the, because again, this is home front. So this is what we're dealing with here in the United States. You're getting a lot of superheroes that were in the USA during World War II. And because you at home demanded it, there are role-playing statistics in this chapter for Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Who's way too strong for a guy who had polio and...
Oh, wow. You had to go there.
Well, I mean, yeah, a little tough. They also explain the tone of Golden Age adventures, which I think is super important and interesting. What kind of heroes you should be making, what their attitudes are. They offer five archetypes, the Mysterious Avenger, the Adventurer, the All-American. Really, they're going for DC's titles, right? Adventure Comics, All-American Comics.
Right,
The Gadgeteer and the Omnipotent Hero, like the Spectre and such. To make the heroes less potent, you know, that's one of the things they do is that superhuman attributes and powers cost more than in the regular game, unless you put a limitation on it, like Our Man's one-hour limit would be a good example. And there's also a more costly but more useful version of military science. It's mostly for the soldiers, but they mention it here. And that chapter has the magic barriers, a map that shows where they can't go or where they would, you know, superpowered characters would be turned to the Axis's will, both in the Pacific and the European theaters. And you know I love maps, so I have to mention it.
If I recall, that was a result of the Spear of Destiny, was it the Holy Grail?
I think it's the Dragon King cast a spell on the other side. So
I think there's one more artifact. I can't remember which one it was, but either way, yeah.
I think that may be it. And then, yeah, you're right. They mentioned the teams, and that's pretty much where I got my idea for the Young All-Stars earlier. I do think they sidelined the Freedom Fighters in this.
Oh, okay.
It was the merging of the Earths, right? It's like when you think of the Freedom Fighters, they're alone on Earth X. It's taken over by Nazis. They win the war, so they're like the rebels. It's much more epic than here. It's like they're guarding shipyards in San Francisco. It doesn't seem much.
Yeah, you're right. After Crisis changed everything, no one really took the time to establish what they were doing.
No.
So yeah, they're kind of left wandering. But you get a big section on All-Star Squadron, a big section on Justice Society of America, you get the Seven Soldiers of Victory, you mentioned Freedom Fighters and Young All-Stars. So it's pretty great. I love it. So DC Heroes role-playing game, we know a lot about it, right? And a lot of people listening may or may not. And, you know, you could play Superman in these games, which, you know, can almost move planets and things like that, right?
I mean, the Spectre.
Yeah, exactly. Right? So how well does this game system handle or differentiate heroes with no metahuman ability. So again, I know you can play Green Lantern and Superman and whatnot, but what happens when you're playing one of these new heroes, a Mysterious Avenger or a Gadgeteer, which are essentially a regular guy with no powers, or the Warfront soldiers? I mean, these are just regular folks. Now, I asked that question, and I'm going to give you a caveat, because I know the real answer is you say, oh, you just give them a personality or a gimmick, but let's take that off the table. You know, let's take off gimmicks, let's take off personality. I'm saying when you have stats that are all in the really low range, which a normal human, just to give you guys at home an idea, a normal human's average ability is like a 2 in most things. Now, you might go up to, you know, an 8 or a 9 if you're really, really good. So most of the characters in this book have somewhere between like a 4 to a 7, mainly 5 and 6 is what they really are. You get characters like, you know, Midnight or Manhunter, 1 and 2, the Jester, Mr. America, the Red Bee. These are regular humans. So how do you think this game system does with handling differentiations between those people so they don't all seem so samey?
You're right that it does make them, you have a smaller pool of abilities to pick from, like in low-powered gaming. But I've, you know, like right now I'm playing in Torg Eternity. I've mentioned this on the show before, on Let's Roll anyways. And there is a pulp hero chasm in there. Some characters are those kinds of low-powered mystery men. Mm-hmm. And there, it's the same problem in a way. But I don't think it is a problem. I think when you decide that that's what you're going to play, in this way you may have only one power, right? Just to make it very grounded. Only a single gadget, only a single gimmick to make you different from someone else. You got to lean into that gimmick. And everyone understands that everyone has their one gimmick or their one specialty, their one tactic that they are going to lean into. And that's what makes them different, rather than having powers to choose from within your archetype. I mean, even Roy Thomas, when he was writing All-Star Squadron, had the same problem. A lot of his guys were just mystery men with that kind of were all similar in terms of ability and even personality. So he invented people like Firebrand, who could shoot flames. He gave powers to people who didn't have any, like Liberty Bell, or create Amazing Man to fit into that because, okay, that's going to be a different power. So he had the same problem when he looked at all the characters that he loved, but that you could only play with those characters and... yeah, the powers are pretty limited.
I think you're right. I think when you're playing a regular human, it is going to definitely come down to the gimmicks, the shtick, and the role-playing ability of the player. I mean, that's really what it's going to come down to. You've got to really lean into it. I mean, if you try and just be the true blue hero, it's going to get pretty dull pretty quick because everyone's the same. So yeah, I think you got to be, you know, the jester, the one who laughs constantly and is throwing rubber chickens or whatever. You got to really be out there. One thing I do feel like the game... this particular book could have done a little better is I feel like they could have expanded the skills better. And I don't even know what skills to name at this point, but I feel like if they had really dug in and thrown a bunch more skills at the wall, that might have been a way you could really differentiate your characters with your skills. I mean, pretty much we just get military science. Other than that, everything else is just what's from the core book.
And each of those skills in the game normally really have a bunch of sub-skills. So I might have gone like, you have to specialize. You have to take sub-skills rather than skills. Mm-hmm. And that would have created more differentiation. Like, we both have military science. No. You're good at tactical. I'm good at camouflage. And right. That becomes our shtick. You know, not everybody has everything in the military skill package, for example.
Yeah. It seems like they just kind of rely on the skill called Scholar. And then just do a subcategory, like, you know, FDR has a scholar of politics
right.
and law, and Red Bee has, you know, a scholar of, you know, beekeeping, you know, things yeah. like that.
I think that's what you have to do in those circumstances, that and, like, you know, your irrational attraction to something.
Yeah.
That creates your gimmick. That's what you have to go with. I mean, you know, your party, if we can call it that, your super team is going to have a lot of crossover between abilities.
Yeah.
So you have to make them complementary as much as possible. But it's not like we've got a brick and we've got a blaster and we've got a wizard.
Exactly.
Although you can do that.
You could. They're just going to be very expensive. Yeah. And that's one of the things actually I really like that they laid out in this book is creating heroes with powers is difficult. Because in the Golden Age, most of them were just mass men or low-powered people. So when you're creating your character, if you get above a certain power level with superpowers, it actually costs you more points to make that character. I really like that. I like that it keeps them from being too superhuman. And you mentioned earlier, the alternative is you can take limitations on that. So like Our Man gets really strong, but the limitation, it's only for 60 minutes, like you mentioned. It's a great one. I do think maybe, though, The book maybe could have used some rules or guidance for the game master on, or the players, keeping them in a theme. Like, because I was looking through this book, and characters like Green Lantern and Johnny Thunder and Miss America, they're like the Spectre in a sense. They're so powerful, they could break any game. I mean, just in a heartbeat. There's no reason Green Lantern shouldn't wipe out everything that he battles. I mean, that kind of thing. So as a game master, if you want to keep it consistent with the Golden Age comic story, or even the Bronze Age All-Star Squadron storytelling, it feels like there should be like some tone setting for the players so that they don't take too much advantage of that. Maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm worrying about something I shouldn't.
I mean, it depends on your group. And like everything else, you need a session zero. You need to tell people what the expectations are. If you're going to be playing in World War II era, with superheroes, which are going to be stuck at home, do we all agree that we're just going to be guys who punch people out? Or do we want, like, superpowers? And then how do we play that? And then I'm going to choose my villains and threats, you know, consequently to that. And we're not going to have, I mean, yes, the JSA has Johnny Thunder, who hardly knows that he has access to powers.
Right.
Right next to Green Lantern and the Flash, right? You don't want anyone that seems useless in a fight, but you give them some other use in combat situations. It's just...
Somehow Al Pratt and the Spectre both have to have something to do.
Yes, exactly. That's crazy.
So I want to mention, too, some of the new advantages are these connections that just, it got me so excited. I love these connections. Basically, what a connection is an advantage where, like, you can contact, you can pick up the phone and call someone that you know for information or help or whatever. And maybe that's a low resource, like maybe the guy working the front desk, or maybe you know the boss, the CEO or whatever or something. In these cases, it's they're like U.S. Armed Forces, the Allied Armed Forces, the government, the White House, the OSS. Like, I don't just the All-Star Squadron, the JSA, the press, reading all of these different new connections just got me so, like, makes me desperately want to play the game now. I'm like, I want to pick up the phone and call the OSS. That sounds so cool. I don't know, silly things. And then there's certain things in here too that, like, if I were doing this as the GM, I would totally just hand wave away. Like, there's a whole thing about sidekick that you can get. And the rules, and maybe you feel differently, but I feel like the rules to building a sidekick are so ridiculously expensive. They're insane amount of points because, like, it's going to take a bunch of points away from your character to develop, to have the sidekick, and then you don't even really get to control them.
I despise the side character stuff. You know, players who want, like, a familiar or sort of a tag beast. I hate all that stuff. I hate keeping track of that stuff. I don't think players are good at keeping track of their own animals.
Yep.
Or silent assistants or whatever it is. I mean, they introduced the sidekick earlier than this. We really want to design a side character using your own points that you're not going to control. And you control them. You're controlling two characters. Why not just have a player be the sidekick? Another player is the sidekick.
So the way I've always done it in games, because I've run a lot of superhero campaigns over the years, is I always just make it a GM-controlled character that, for the most part, I develop, too. I, like, you know, saddle my player with a sidekick and say, you're the jester? Well, now you have a sidekick called Maroon, you know, is a silly jester-type character as well. And usually what I do is I make them supportive. I also make them prone to getting into trouble. And most of the time, I just get them out of the way. I'm like, okay, you know, that side character is going to go off and do their own adventure for a while, and it'll come back if the plot merits it, like if I need them to get kidnapped or something. And I've had two different campaigns where we built up so many sidekicks in that way to various players that I then ran subsequent adventures where the players all played the sidekicks as like a sort of a Teen Titans sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it worked out brilliantly. It was so much fun both times. Everybody loved it. It was really a cool idea. Then, okay, a couple other hand wave things like wealth rules. There's rules in here about how money works in the 1940s. Like, I don't know how you do wealth in games. I don't care. Same. I spend enough time in my real life dealing with spreadsheets and financial information anyway.
Wealth and encumbrance are two of the things I can't make myself care.
Exactly. Yep. It's like, I just kind of look at the character. If they've got a job, if they've got money, yes, you can buy it. You know, if you're Peter Parker, barely making ends meet, no, you can't.
Well, I mean, that kind of DC Heroes already gave you that in the sense that wealth is a stat. So you want to buy something? Roll your wealth in the same way you'd roll your strength or your intelligence. This being one of the early games that I played, I felt like, yeah, this is the way to go.
Yeah.
Let's just roll on it. I'd rather do that than have people keep track of gold pieces.
Right, exactly. There's also a section here about building gadgets, and they actually tell, they make building a gadget, and gadget rules are always complicated in any game I've ever played, but they make it even harder to build a gadget here, I guess with the philosophy that, back in the 1940s, they didn't have as much cool stuff. Given that you're playing characters that are more than likely have no powers, and a gadget is their shtick, I would have made gadgets easier to build, actually. I would have made gadgets super easy to build, but then just sort of make it sort of like the powers thing, put a cap on it. Like, okay, if the gadget's going to be too powerful, it's going to get really hard to make.
Yeah.
But if it's a low-level gadget, let everybody have a gadget. Why not? It just seems like that would be more in theme with the universe.
I agree.
And then I do want to mention there's some fun scenarios in here. So it's basically saying, as a game master, if you're going to run some adventures, you know, here are some ideas for types of adventures you can run. And you get the Axis Saboteurs, which is, you know, I think the name explains itself. Obviously, they're trying to do that. The Counter Hero Raid, which is an idea where the Axis decide to try and eliminate the heroes before they become a threat. The MacGuffin Chase, which is what every great Bronze Age comic is all about, where all the characters have to go chase something down. The Propaganda Coup, where you're trying to, you know, have some sort of, you know, victory in the press kind of thing. Maybe you're trying to turn a spy or whatever. And then the Supervillain Master Plan was just out there for any generic supervillains that may not necessarily be Axis characters. So those are some fun ideas. And I do like that it tells you in here, pretty much your NPCs, you're going to need to introduce some reoccurring scientists to your hero friends, because so many of these plots involve science going wrong. So I love that idea.
I mean, in all my superhero games, I always played a member of the team who stayed at home, and he was always a scientist.
Yep.
To do these bits of business.
All right. We're ready to move on to the chapter. This is the one that you're here for, folks. This is chapter 3, The Homefront Heroes. This has stats for every, well, I shouldn't say every, most Golden Age and World War II era superheroes active on U.S. soil. It is 30 pages or 29 pages long. Again, I already told you the fascinating part about it is that these are the stats as of 1943, which is great. And each one has commentary on them from, am I right in saying it's Captain Nazi? Is that right?
There's like a Nazi agent who writes the powers and skills section, mm-hmm. and then Captain Nazi writes over those notes.
Sometimes completely contradicting them.
Yeah, well, I'm of two minds about this. I love the flavor, but we had not have had notes from someone friendly to our heroes. You know, for example, we're going to get to those entries, but like the first entry is Airwave, just to give an example. And we're told he's one of the weakest Americans. Even if, ironically, it mentions the shame felt by a prominent Nazi defeated by Airwave. Never mind that, you know, Captain Nazi throughout thinks female heroes suck. So the point is, you should make me want to play Airwave or any of these others except Johnny Thunder. No, I'm mostly kidding. But yes, because I like the flavor, I'll let it go. But, you know, each of these comments are signed with a swastika. There's an awful lot of swastikas in the book as a result.
Yeah.
And it does make me feel like Captain Nazi fought most Homefront heroes at some point. You know, sometimes he says, I never met them. But it's like Captain Nazi needs stuff to do now that Earth-S is merged with Earth-2.
I was going to say, he's that's the guy from the Shazam comics, right?
Right. He was mostly fighting Captain Marvel Jr.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Who our listeners call Blue Shazam. And, you know, so it's now he has nobody because the Marvel family has been moved up time.
Yeah.
They're not in World War II, so he has nothing to do except scribble on on other agents' files. I think the big limitation of this section, and tell me if you think the same, but almost everyone is a floating head. You'd have to track down copies of Who's Who to know what these guys look like in uniform. Some heroes don't even have a headshot. All these headshots, by the way, are all from Who's Who Update 87, number one.
Well, like the All-Star Squadron entry or something?
Yeah, the All-Star Squadron. There's like Young All-Stars one page and then a huge spread with everybody. And it's all those heads.
Oh, wow. I didn't even realize that. Okay.
Another limitation that this has is that we don't get role-playing notes for anyone. You know, we get that in the preceding chapter. I guess it's totally correct. You know, they tell us that everyone's kind of the same within their motivation or their archetype. And then some of the Nazis' notes do sometimes provide a bit of clarity or, you know, you mentioned the jester laughing, etc. That's in there. But generally, like, I like it when there is a little section that says, you know, like a role-playing note, how to play this character or use this character. That's not in there, except if when you read between the lines.
Yeah, like the Adam, you know, the Captain Nazi is complaining, is saying his only real weakness lies in his imprudent temper and his ability to affect his judgment. So that it's giving you a little bit that, you know, okay, Adam's a hothead. know, that kind of thing. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. It doesn't give you, like, as a player, it doesn't give you a template for you to know how to play the character. That's true.
Though I agree that in the original comics, I'm not talking about like All-Star Squadron or the All-Star Comics revival or anything like that. But in the original Golden Age comics, which I've read quite a lot of, you know, most characters are kind of the same. They're all kind of Peter Parker type. You know, they have that banter. Very, very simple.
I think you're being a bit generous. I think Peter Parker's pretty darn funny. So I struggle reading a lot of the Golden Age actual comics because the characters are just so, I have to go stop the bad guy because it's the right thing to do. And it's just very true blue, a little dull. That's just my take on it.
Exactly. It's not like it's full of characterization. So tonally, in that sense, thematically, I guess it makes sense not to have that section. But we're 91. We know characters have personalities. Let's discuss them a little more clearly for a potential player.
Or at the very least, tell you to go buy Who's Who. One or the other. No. I don't know. Something. But
it's not like Who's Who says personality.
Sure, it's 5 years old at this point, too, if you think about it. Yeah. Or 6 years old. Some of the Who's Who comics are 6 years old. Yeah. Oof. Okay. All right, well, we're going to name check every character in this book. We are not going to sit there and dwell on every single character, because quite frankly, Siskoid and I have nothing to say about Judo Master. But we are going to name check them all, and then we'll highlight some ones that we find something interesting to talk about.
Right. So, I will say I love Judo Master, but I don't have a note on him.
I just said we weren't going to talk about
him. We're not, but I just wanted to clarify that I do love Judo Master.
He just wants to clarify we're not going to talk about Judo Master by talking about Judo Master.
Correct.
Okay, here we go. Airwave, which we've talked about a little. Amazing Man. I found one thing interesting in there. They talk about his powers. He has magnetic... Well, first he starts off with the molecular chameleon, where he can change into anything. But then he has magnetic control powers. I have no recollection of that. I guess that's in the late All-Star Squadron comics or something?
It's not that late, because it says up to May 1942, he had molecular chameleon. I guess they changed it during the series.
Right, well, that's what I mean. But I mean, keep in mind, like, those comics lasted, like...
May 1942, would that be, like, in their world... Young All-Stars, and they made the change during that second series.
Maybe, I'm not sure. And someone at home's yelling into their Zune or their Zonaphone saying, oh, of course it was in All-Star Squadron 44. And I'm sorry, I don't remember that, folks. All right, next up is the Atom, Al Pratt.
Yeah, I'm not sure frowning on short jokes is a serious irrational attraction, but this is the way that they try to put the personality in there. So I appreciate it, but also a serious irrational attraction to frowning on short jokes is not...
Well, I think they're trying to show his hot-headed temper, and they're trying to say if someone makes a short joke, he's going to punch him in the face, is what he's trying to say.
Yes, I suppose. And then it's up to you as a game master to make short jokes.
Exactly. Right. Captain Nazi's the kind of guy that would do that. Mm-hmm. All right, then we have the Black Condor, Captain Triumph, Commander Steel, one of our stars of All-Star Squadron, the Crimson Avenger and his sidekick Wing.
Oh, yes. Wing and the other sidekicks... are placed right after the boss. So it's not Wing in the W's. It's always going to be right after the main hero, which keeps all the families together. I approve.
All right. I'm sure they're sleeping more sound knowing that Siskoid signed off on it. Then we get Dr. Fate, Kent Nelson.
I have a problem here.
Uh-oh. Well, I think I have a solution, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, if you're going to use a pick of half-mask Fate, as it is here, you should offer those stats in parallel with the full helmet Fate. Which is all the stats are full helmet. So there's no way the supermanified Fate also has a strength of 4 here. I recently covered something on the Crisis podcast where he squeezed oxygen out of moon rocks. I mean, the trade-off was he went at half mask, but he had like Superman-like powers.
Well, all right. So I think what you're seeing here is...
Yes, what am I seeing?
And I may be stretching it a bit. Because if you take away the helmet, he still has invulnerability of 15, like Superman. And he has telekinesis of 10, which I think he's using as strength.
Oof.
I know, that part is a stretch. I admit that.
I don't disagree that that's how you could use it. But I don't know. Also, we just saw Amazing Man had 2 stats. This period and this period. And they didn't do this for Dr. Fate. I don't know.
You're right. No, that's a good call. Good call. After Dr. Fate, we get Dr. Midnight, Charles McKnighter.
Yeah, Charles McKnighter. In the egregious omission category, I would like to submit his trained owl, Hootie, even though I hate tracking animal familiars. other characters in this have their animal familiars. Where's the owl? I love that owl.
Fair enough. Everyone loves Dr. Midnight's owl, so that's very fair.
All right, I won't interrupt at every character.
No, it's okay. No, we said there's certain ones we want to talk about. There's Dr. Occult. There is Dollman. There is Firebrand 1. There is Firebrand 2. So Firebrand 1, of course, is Rod, and Firebrand 2 is Danny, his sister, or Danette, his sister, who every red-blooded American should have had a crush on, because I certainly did. The Flash, Jay Garrick. The Flying Fox from Young All-Stars.
Oh, yeah, see, it weirdly pays lip service to rituals, but doesn't give him powers that those rituals give him, even though they say he doesn't need to make the occultist check to cast those rituals.
Well, it's weird. It says he has the powers. It says he has chameleon, comprehend language, flame project, illusion, and invisibility powder, each at 8 APs. He says he has the powers, but it's not listed in any other kind of grid like all the other ones are.
Yeah,
it's very strange.
They were trying to push rituals because the magic source book had come out or was going to come out, and I think was going to come out. It's wonky here.
Also, here's your Canadian representative. So there you go, Cisco.
Yes.
And also, he is a continuity patch for Batman,
right?
That's how the Young All-Stars came about, was each one of them are a continuity patch for someone that got wiped out in post-crisis.
Right.
So I compared his stats to the Golden Age Batman stats, which we'll talk more about later, and he's nowhere on scale with Golden Age Batman. So just worth noting.
No, the Young All-Stars had to be lesser powered than the people they replaced, although I think there is an exception or two.
Oh, I was about to say, I love it when you're wrong, because the very next character is Fury, who is, of course, Helena Cosmatos, or however you say her last name. She is the post-crisis patch for Wonder Woman. And here, it tells you by May 1942, she is, in fact, stronger and tougher, very much so, than the Golden Age Wonder Woman. And she can run and jump more than her as well. So Fury is much more powerful than the Golden Age Wonder Woman, which is interesting. All right, up next is Green Lantern, Alan Scott. Yay! The Guardian. Here is where I mention something that's missing. There's no Newsboy Legion in here.
Oh.
And I did look it up. They were introduced in 1942.
I mean, the Guardian doesn't exist without them. There's no Guardian strips. They're Newsboy Legion strips. And the Guardian is in the, you know, in the background of those. They should be in here.
Yeah, and he does mention the Newsboy Legion in the entry, but they don't get their own stats. And I double-checked, they didn't come out in 1942, so there's no reason they shouldn't be in here. So we've done Guardian. Now we're going to talk about Hawkman and Hawkgirl, Carter Hall and Shiera Hall, with their goofy little masks with the beaks, which are so funny. We've got Rex Tyler, Hourman. We've got the Human Bomb. Then we've got Iron Monroe. I love this character personally. I absolutely love the idea of Iron Monroe. I love the way he's created. I love the connection to the Gladiator book. Now, one thing about this one is, though, I did, again, compared him to the Golden Age Superman, because he's a continuity patch for Golden Age Superman. He is stronger, tougher, and more invulnerable than the Golden Age Superman. So really, it's just the Flying Fox that falls short for the most part.
Neptune Perkins, probably.
Yeah, it's true. We don't have Golden Age stats for Aquaman, though, unfortunately. Yeah, so no, because there was no Earth 2 Aquaman. All right, the Jester. You like how I slipped that in? The Jester. Then we've got Johnny Quick.
Yes, one of my favorite All-Star Squadron members. Amusingly, I guess. Yeah, he's so fast that in the notes, Captain Nazi considers him a myth.
Right, which is fun. In fact, don't they think that people... Yeah, he says, like, no, they were just fighting the Flash and they're mistaken or something like that.
Yeah, so it's funny. But also, if you look at those old Johnny Quick strips, they were comedy forward.
Oh, okay.
Compared to Flash, yeah.
Now, one thing I stumbled across here is one of his limitations is obviously, you know, to activate his powers, he has to say that magic formula, right?
Yep.
But this also indicates he has another formula he has to say to stop using his super speed, which sort of kind of sounds familiar in the back of my head, and I'm sure it's legit to the Golden Age, but I don't remember ever seeing that in any modern age stuff. I don't remember that in All-Star Squadron.
Yeah, if it's anywhere, it's like there is a secret origin issue in All-Star Squadron.
Yeah.
Towards the back when it was like a lame duck series. That's maybe it's in there.
Now, here's something that blew my mind, is it says that Johnny Quick found this formula on a piece of papyrus, or actually his friend of his, Professor Ezra Gill, discovered the formula on a piece of papyrus he removed from the ancient tomb of King Amen of Egypt. How on earth has no one done a comic connecting the Speed Force in ancient Egypt along with, you know, the Egyptian Naboo, the Egyptian Teth Adam, which is Black Adam, the Egyptian pharaohs of Hawkman and Hawkgirl? Like, we see these adventures of JSA characters as existed in ancient Egypt. How is there not a Johnny Quick running around with them? How come no one's ever done that? That blows my mind.
Surprising.
Then we get to Johnny Thunder. There's a couple things here I gotta mention. First of all, I love one of the things they do here, where in order to activate the Thunderbolt, he has to roll on his luck. Basically, he has an ability called Dumb Luck, and he has to roll on, because he doesn't know He's such an idiot. He doesn't know that he's accidentally saying the magic word of say you. He like, you know, fumbles in his sentence like, say you, come back with that gold watch. And he doesn't even realize he's activated the genie. So you actually roll in his dumb luck to see if he accidentally says the magic word, which I think is hilarious.
It's well done.
But my favorite part of this is, where is this? Okay. They talk about how as a child, the almost unbelievably naive Johnny Thunder was kidnapped by monks from the distant land of Adnesia. They instilled in him the power to summon and command the mystical thunderbolt, hoping he would one day lead them to glory. Instead, Johnny became a boxing champion, a rodeo clown, a sailor, a G-man, a crime fighter, in roughly that order. So clearly the writer was having fun here, building up with the Badnesian expected versus what Johnny Thunder delivered. Crack me up. All right. The aforementioned Juno Master and his sidekick, Tiger. We get Liberty Bell. We get, as I can try to flip the page, because I'm dealing with a real physical book here, Manhunter 1 and his sidekick, Thor the Thunderdog. Manhunter 2, which is your Paul Kirk. Midnight, who's a ripoff of the Spirit. Miss America, who is insanely powerful. She can change matter at an insane... She's more powerful than Firestorm as far as changing matter. It's crazy how powerful she is. And no mention of her sidekicks, Molly Pitcher and Betsy Ross, which is disappointing.
They were all still forgotten at that point, all those sidekicks. Yeah, Miss America is problematic. They kept trying to make her happen, but then the writers never did anything. Like, she got, like, two different Who's Who pages, and still she's not doing anything in the books. I don't know. That was a strange one.
It's when they made her the continuity patch for Wonder Woman. That's what they said. Miss America was a continuity patch for Wonder Woman. She was the secretary of the JSA and all. I guess they had expectations that Roy Thomas or somebody would do more with that, and no one was touching that at all. So, yeah.
So Wonder Woman has had, like, three continuity patches for World War II.
What? Fury, Miss America, and what?
Hippolyta.
Oh, Polly. Okay, yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. She has almost as many as Superboy in the Legion.
Yeah, it's crazy.
All right, so then Mr. America, also the America Commando, and the person we never forget from the Golden Age comic. Mr. Terrific, Neptune Perkins, Phantom Lady. Okay, this is where we get into a crime here, all right? But one of the original advantages in the main core book, which they apply to a lot of characters, is attractive, right? It makes you attractive. It gives you some charisma sort of things.
Yep.
Phantom Lady does not have the attractive advantage. That's insane. In fact, I went through every single hero in here. The only heroes that have attractive are Miss America and Firebrand 1, Rod the Guy. So no Phantom Lady. Now, I mean, he's a handsome guy with that diaphanous shirt.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah.
You know, no Phantom Lady, no Firebrand 2, Danette, no Liberty Bell, no Hawkgirl. Are you Dave Stevens would like to have a word with the people who wrote this book.
It's very weird. And I was like, well... You know, it's like Phantom Lady has had different periods and she's been at different comics companies. And some of them, she was very demure. It was like, no, no. At our company, she is not a sex pot. And then at other publishers, oh, she's definitely a sex pot, you know. And in the modern era, we know her as a sex pot.
Yeah.
But it's missing here. So I guess this is one of her non-sex pot eras when she was at like Fox Publishing or something.
Just ridiculous. All right. Then we get The Ray. Then we get the Red Bee. Hello, Red Bee. And his bee swarm as his sidekicks.
Well, I disagree with that.
Okay.
I mean, it's kind of overstating things. Most of the time, and I wish they'd mentioned this, but most of the time it was one trained bee called Michael.
It was really two.
Well, there's two, but Michael was the main one.
Yeah, he was.
But I do like this. Is like it's animal handling as a superpower. You don't see that a lot. Captain Nazi thinks he's an escaped lunatic. So there's a lot of shade here.
That is so funny.
And it also, and this is the weird part, is that they mentions his survival after Bane broke his back.
Bane. Baron Blitzkrieg.
Baron
perhaps.
Blitzkrieg. Okay, yeah. It's weird, isn't it? There's, and I look for it. Is there a story?
Yeah, he says, but I have seen the Red Bee myself since then, so the Baron is undoubtedly mistaken. Like, well, what?
I researched it, and there is, after he gets his back broken, that's considered his death.
Right.
There's no reappearance in that continuity. Later, yes, but not in that continuity.
Maybe Ray Wininger knew what they were going to do with the Peacemaker story where Red Bee's his control.
That's it's far in advance. No, maybe he hoped.
So we'll keep going. So here we get, next we get Robot Man, which is of course Robot Man from the All-Star Squadron. You get the Sandman, Wesley Dodds, and Sandy the Golden Boy. Sargon the Sorcerer, the Shining Knight with his sidekick of Winged Victory. You get the Spectre. Talk about a world breaker. Oh my gosh, those stats are insane, man. They're crazy. They're so big. Starman, meaning Ted Knight. The Star-Spangled Kid and his sidekick of Stripesy, which is always a fun, weird combination. You get Tarantula, the Tigress, who will grow up to, in her later years, to be the Huntress, who's a villain. You get TNT, who is deceased, and his sidekick, Dan the Dynamite. You get Tsunami, and you get Uncle Sam, who is insanely powerful. A strength of what, a scale of 17, folks? That is insane how strong Uncle Sam is.
He was the Earth X Superman. When you look at old National Comics, like he was so strong, he could do anything.
Just crazy. Then we get Vigilante and his sidekick, Stuff the Chinatown Kid. Boy, that aged well. Then we get The Whip. And I love Captain Nazi's comment on here. It's like there's a description by, like, you know, the regular Nazi commentator. And then you get to Captain Nazi's and it literally just says, The what? Which is so funny.
The what?
Then we get Wildcat, Ted Grant, hooray. And then we end with Zatara the Magician. But that Wildcat, I mean, he's just amazing. Everyone loves Wildcat, right?
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing about, I do have a complaint about his stats, is that he has a martial arts, which is ranked 8, which, folks, I know we're not trying to get too much crunch into the numbers, but his martial arts of ranked 8, I think, since that's supposed to be subbing for his boxing, or, you know, it should be much higher. I think it's, an 8 is far too low for him.
A lot of these guys were just punch-em-ups.
Yeah.
And Wildcat was no different. And today we know him as, don't forget, it's like, yeah, sure, he's a boxer, but is he any more of a boxer than the Atom is, et cetera? Yeah, a little bit. You know, today we know him as the guy who trained everybody, and everybody he didn't train was trained by Lady Shiva, right? That's what we said.
Right, yeah, that's the rule of thumb, yeah. But pretty much, as I flip through this, almost everyone has martial arts at 7.
So he's got twice as much with an 8. With the scale on this game.
That is true. One number higher does mean twice as much. But the Shining Knight is as good as a fighter, a martial artist, as Wildcat. And I think at this point, he is like heavyweight champion of the world at this point. So I think it should be higher. But either way.
The body of 6. Mm-hmm. Okay. Normally, strength and body, there's a human limit.
Yeah.
5 for strength and 6 for body. But 6 is like... That's incredible. That's Batman-level endurance. And I love that he has a 6, kind of like the only human guy with that much body, because it feels very Rocky.
Okay.
If we look at the Nazi files on this, he's one of the few heroes that Captain Nazi actively respects.
Ooh, okay.
So I think Wildcat gets his due, you know?
Love me a Ted Grant.
I'm not unhappy with that.
A couple different things. There are some fun comments in here. Like under the Nazi and Captain Nazi commentary, I do feel like they were playing with some of the wording for the Young All-Stars continuity patches. Like in Iron Monroe, they describe him. They don't use these words, but they're pretty much just rattling off. Faster than the speeding bullet. Able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, which was fun. I liked that. Neptune Perkins, one of the lines is, another boy trying to do a man's job. I felt like that was a dig, you know, a man's job, meaning Aquaman. I thought that was fun in there.
I really doubt there's anyone missing. You mentioned the Newsboy Legion, who aren't superheroes. But in terms of superheroes, I don't think there's anyone who was in Who's Who anyways that's missing. Black Canary and Doll Girl don't appear. They premiered post-war. So, okay. So there's no Black Canary. So that, you know, you don't have your full JSA there.
True.
So it's not a Golden Age source. It really is a World War II source book. It's that those years. Unless, of course, they were erased from continuity. So Plastic Man's not in here. The Marvel family's not in here. You know, no wonder Captain Nazi has so much free time to devote to journaling. Kid Eternity's not in here. So it's all those people have been pushed forward in time.
I like to think Captain Nazi, besides journaling, he likes scrapbooks.
Scrapbooking and, yeah, you know, bird watching. So, okay, we're at the end of this chapter here. So let me ask you, if you were to play a home front campaign, with pre-generated heroes.
Okay, so existing heroes, gotcha.
Who would you want to call dibs on? Your top three.
Okay, so I did get some fore notice that you were going to ask this question. So I had some time to think about it. I don't want to pretend like, oh, let me think. No, I really spent a lot. I spent too much time actually thinking about it. That was the problem. So I ended up going for archetypes first is what I kept picking too many people. And I'm going to cheat. I'm going to give you more than three, so tough luck. I like a super strong character. I like to punch people in role-playing games. I don't know what it is. That's my go-to thing is the super strong tank guy. Whether he has invulnerability or not is irregardless. I like to be strong and punch people in a role-playing game. I can't tell you why. It just brings me joy. So Iron Man Rowe would probably be my first pick because, I love the concept of that character. I love the whole idea behind him being the Superman fill-in. I like playing the Golden Age Superman without being trapped by the Golden Age Superman sort of rules and the Golden Age Superman history. I could, Iron Man Rowe, you can kind of do your own thing. Failing that, I'd take Our Man as another strong character, which is great. Then I thought about Mystery Man. Who do I want to play as the Mystery Man type character? That was pretty easy. Dr. Midnight and Tarantula both have such cool looks, cool backgrounds, being a doctor, being a journalist. I love those ideas. I think there's a lot of, subplots you could do with that. I think that'd be a lot of fun. And then Energy Blaster, someone with powers. I thought, okay, who would I want to play with powers? No doubt. Firebrand 2, Danette. Part of that is because she's smoking hot and have a huge crush on this redheaded lady. Other half is that she's just awesome. I love the power set. I love her attitude. I love her indomitable will. So yeah, those are my three. What about you?
Well, I went with my gut, really. There's a lot of characters here I would like to play because I'm a Golden Age guy. But it would be the Red Bee. I think there's a lot you can do with that trained bee that would be like surprising. I wouldn't play him as a comedy character or anything.
Right.
Robot Man was one of my favorite all-stars.
Oh, okay.
So that's my puncher. That's my brick, right? And I like that he had like a more soul than a lot of the others. There's something about that. He's a brain in a jar. Not quite Cliff Steele, but he's getting there. And then I also picked a lady, Liberty Bell, another of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
What I would love to do is... when the Liberty Bell sounds, the real Liberty Bell sounds, she has like a boost of energy, a boost of power. So how can I make that happen in the game? The bell will ring, So I'd love to work around those problems.
Well, didn't she have a guy she would call? And like,
I think
hey,
that's it, but you can't just...
Phil, can you go ring the bell?
But nobody has a mobile or anything, so it's...
true.
Anyway, it gets complicated. I would have loved to plan these things out or say that I planned them and then the game master has to agree. I'd spend the hero points. Let's look at the next chapter. We're done with heroes, or Homefront heroes anyways. There's a chapter on Golden Age villains. You want some threats for your heroes. 14 pages, tons of World War II era bad guys. Again, commentary on each of them, but this time is from various All-Star Squadron members. So that's fun. And they switch it up. Sometimes it's very much the heroes that are associated with them. Sometimes it's just like your random All-Star. So fair play on the notes. There's no font change the way there was for the Nazis. I don't know why there's a different format.
You're right.
There's no powers or history section. It's like they're not following the same rules from chapter to chapter, which is odd. I guess if the All-Star doesn't know all the info, then it can't be told. But they usually find a way. Like the Unknown Soldier reports on Captain Nazi's origin story in a report that Liberty Bell got her hands on.
Right.
They have to find some way. So this is what makes this book an enjoyable read. It's not dry. You're reading in the voices of the villains and heroes who are evaluating each other. And so it's very flavorful. That's probably why I read it all the way through back in the day. So there's some interesting, fun ones throughout. Maybe we'll just go through the names the same way.
Okay.
So Axis America, that's a bunch of DC Star analogs, right? Because
it's evil JLA. There's a Superman, a Wonder Woman, a Batman, a Robin, an Aquaman, a Green Arrow.
Do you like that?
No.
Again, another Wonder Woman, by the way.
Right. Yeah, there you go. On paper, they seem really cool. They really, and if you read this, looks cool, and you can think of all these cool adventures, but unfortunately, it was just never all that compelling in the comics, and that's probably more a result of Roy Thomas's in his later years, and once Earth 2 is taken away from him, that's probably more a result of that, but it's a fun idea, and I think you could do a lot in the game with it, more so than it was probably done in the comics.
Right, it's open for business, I like in this part, Tsunami's five-word assessment of Seawolf. Seawolf is a pig, period. Who else we got? We got Baron Blitzkrieg. We got Brainwave. Captain Nazi, of course, the star of the book.
Right, sort of.
Cyclotron, Deathbolt, the Dragon King, the Dummy. So this is an interesting one that I had to check up on because here they decided he's not made of wood. Because Roy Thomas said he was in All-Star Squadron.
Oh, okay.
Like the Green Lantern's ring doesn't work on him. It's like proof that he's an actual dummy and not a guy who looks like a ventriloquist dummy. But no other story has confirmed this before or after. So I agree with the DC Heroes RPG staff here.
Yeah, I always assumed he was just a real guy, which is where the ventriloquist and the dummy in the Batman realm, it becomes such a more sort of interesting character, but yeah.
Yeah. The Fiddler, the Gambler, Harlequin.
So I real quick on this one, like, I love that Green Lantern does the commentary on this one. I love that he is, like, he's describing her and he doesn't understand why she's committing these crimes. It's like, he's completely oblivious to the fact she's infatuated with him, which is, it's funny to read it if you know it. And then also, I mean, fast forward, it does sort of track with modern storytelling for Alan Scott as well.
It's definitely how it was played in the original Green Lantern stories. I think mm-hmm. most superheroes seem to think girls had cooties until the Bronze Age.
Until Clark started dating Lois?
Yeah. All right, page 79, Ian Carcool, your favorite.
Oh, it's weird. I don't seem to have a page 79 on my book. I think I must have ripped that page out.
Because I can include him in my games and make my heroes long-lived for my legacy campaign. Finally.
You lucky guy.
Icicle. We got Kulak.
Okay, so this is interesting because in the JSA in the 90s comics and the podcast, we just finished covering the issues with Kulak, which is sort of embarrassing because me and most of my guests forgot who this guy even was. None of us remember him. And yet this book says he is the most powerful adversary the All-Star Squadron has ever faced.
Sorcery 42. That's way off the scale.
That is insane. Now, this would have been published 2 years before he appeared in the JSA in the 90s comics. So, wow, I guess there's something to it.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's like the guy you send against the Spectre, basically.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, his first appearance was All-Star Comics number 2, fighting the Spectre. So, yeah. Oh, they also have his Undead Warrior stats in here, too.
Well, yeah, of course. But no Hootie, the Owl.
Kung.
We got Mechanique, Night and Fog, Perdegaton, the Phantom of the Fair. That's a surprise.
It was. Well, I like to see this in here because you get a nice commentary in here from both Crimson Avenger and Sandman, which makes perfect sense.
Well, they both had a run-in with him in Secret Origins number 7.
Exactly.
Which I covered on Ryan Daly's Secret Origins podcast, so that's why I remember it. Also, Phantom of the Fair is a really weird character because he was a superhero for another company and then somehow wound up at DC Comics where they made him a villain.
Well, I think it's a... I think because it was probably... Well, I don't know if it would have fallen into no copyright issue or not, but that Phantom... Because I did some research on that too. That Phantom of the Fair was spelled with an F.
Right.
This one's spelled with a PH. The
same. It was the black leotard with the red cape. The same, same. Anyway.
At this point, who's going to sue him?
Exactly.
By 1987, who's going to sue?
Pretty obscure. He at least got a Who's Who page. The most obscure character in this whole thing because he didn't get a Who's Who page is the Red Panzer. He premiered in the 1970s. It was like flashback stories or stories about the Golden Age Wonder Woman. You know, he has an unreasoning hatred of women. Has he met Captain Nazi, though?
Nah.
I didn't even remember the Red Panzer, and I looked him up, and it's like, oh, yeah, I guess. But
I guess we just bump into different things, because, like, for me, Red Panzer's not obscure at all.
Okay.
Like, maybe I've just, like, Phantom of the Fair, other than that Secret Origins, I completely forgot that character even existed, whereas Red Panzer, I've bumped into him several times, so I don't know whether it's just that we read different books or maybe I just read some weird obscure ones. There's another weird thing in here too is the comment section, the article is talking all about Red Panzer and it's written by Miss Liberty, which I'm like, wait, Miss Liberty. That is a Revolutionary War era character. That's a mistake. It's got to be Miss America, I'm sure, because Miss America is a stand-in for Wonder Woman. Yep. And this was a Wonder Woman villain in the Bronze Age, as you said. That's got to be what it
typo.
Is.
Typo for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we have The Shade, Solomon Grundy, Ooh. The Sportsmaster, Sumo the Samurai, The Thinker, The Ultra-Humanite before the White Ape body.
So here's the interesting thing is, this is, you know, the Ultra-Humanite, and he's in the body of Dolores Winters at this point. So, you know, he's the smoking hot movie actress. In fact, the freaking Ultra-Humanite gets the attractive advantage and even specifies in Winter's body only, whereas again Phantom Lady doesn't. What? It's just not right.
She was a film star. Like, she deserves it. Dolores deserves it. But I'm not sure they'd be using it in the way that attractive is used. You know, it's like a bump on charisma. Was the Ultra Humanite like using it for seduction?
If you read the 1992-93 JSA series, when they fight Ultra Humanite,
okay,
every one of the guys makes a comment about how hot she was.
Okay.
It's like, it's really inappropriate at one point. They're like, I used to, you know, we'd fight Ultra Humanite. Man, that Dolores Winter, she was pretty easy on the eyes, man.
Well, attractive then. Vandal Savage, The Wizard, Wotan, and Zyklon is in here, the super speed Nazi. My last comment really on this is that I think Black Canary should complain because they cut her out because she's post-war. But a lot of these supervillains, the Fiddler, Icicle, Sportsmaster and his exploding balls, Harlequin, and the Wizard are also all post-war. There's a big difference in JSA Comics and All-Star Comics during the war and after the war. After the war, there's no Nazis to take care of. So they started to create supervillains. And a lot of the supervillains are the ones that we remember and that became part of the Injustice Society. But all of that business is like 1947 and on. So I guess they were around before, but we didn't know.
I didn't pick up on that. Good catch.
Chapter 5, you ready for action on the war front?
I am ready for action on the war front.
So this is the introduction to the theaters of war, the soldier section. It's 7 pages. It outlines special rules for creating new warfront heroes, including selecting which theater of operations, European, Pacific, African, so on. Details on that new military skill, science skill. Military ranks are in here. Rules for all types of battles, including like staging like large scale battles, which is interesting and kind of really easy and smooth to do. These, of course, are based not on Golden Age stories, but on war comics, which had their heyday more or less in the 60s, you know, 70s. They went on until the early 80s. That's when they were mostly popular. And they have a very different tone than actual Golden Age stories. This is where the game has to cater to so-called normal guys. That's the tougher part, because everybody's got like 2-3 in every stat, you know?
Right. All the soldiers in Easy Company are basically the same stats with just minor fluctuations, except one's the ice cream guy, you know, this sort of thing. So like, you know, how do you differentiate them? It's hard.
Right. It has to be the personality. I mean, DC did have, to their credit, an awful lot of weird War II material that perhaps lends itself best to a superhero system. And Wininger suggests you find a crazy hook for your own frontline heroes. And I like the examples they give. There's the examples from the comics, you know, the haunted tank, the Viking commando, the unknown soldier. But page 87 here has a lot of fun original examples as well. I feel like they're the kind of stuff that Robert Kaniger might have thought of.
Oh, yeah. They're super cool. Absolutely.
Really
cool.
Fun, interesting bits. And then we have, the soldiers all have some built-in advantages. I like that. It's like instead of making people pay for being part of a unit and having access to military resources, that's all built in. That's not make people pay for something that they all have in common. That's cool. Advantages and drawbacks, for that matter.
And this is where I said it earlier. I was just bears repeating again. I just really feel like an expansion of skills to go along with those advantages and drawbacks
right. Really
could have helped differentiate your characters more. So I just feel like it's a missed opportunity.
There's a nice discussion on motivations, what they mean to a serviceman as opposed to superhero. And of course, killing combat, pretty much always active. So that's a difference. Yep. So there's a dose of realism to how far you can push your abilities as well. You can't push them as far as a superhero might. How quickly you recover from damage, what special moves you can use, that's all more restrained, more grounded.
I want to jump in there real quick about us pushing your abilities. There's one thing I love in here. When you play this game, you acquire things called hero points, which is where the name of this podcast comes from. And in here, it says to push your character, you can spend 5 hero points to ignore your weapon's range or its ammo limitations. Which I think is such a great comic book idea, because like how many times have you read a war comic where, you know, the bad guy's too far away, but, you know, if I just get the right shot, I'm going to make it. Or, you know, that guy should have ran out of ammo weeks ago or something. Anyway, just the idea of spending some hero points to, you know, get that one last ditch move. I just think that's a great, very comic booky move.
Almost like an action movie kind of element.
Yeah.
And like I said, rules for field battles to adjudicate large scale stuff. Basically, it just treats units as you would individuals in a one-on-one battle, and you can use these rules in fights between a powerful hero and the whole unit. So you want your Spectre or to fight a whole unit? It's as easy as that. Same way that it's depicted in comics.
On paper, those rules read really smooth. It does read really... Like, I read it too, and I'm like, okay, yeah. That's not complicated. I can make sense of that.
That's part of something I've used in other games. You know,
oh, yeah.
Because it is so easy. Oh, yeah, of course. Let's just do it that way, you know. And there are also rules for aerial dogfights, I think are pretty cool, too. Basically, you use your vehicle skill to maneuver yourself so that you have a better shot at your enemy and that they have a worse shot at you. Also done very elegantly, you score result attribute points, you know, the usual, the wraps. And then you strategically assign them to your various opponents. Who do you want to have a worse shot? Who do you want to get a good shot against? And you sort of split up your result points among your various opponents. So I can feel like, okay, yeah, you know, I could play Blackhawks and make that work. And it's, again, elegant, which is something we've said often about DC Heroes RPG, you know. And then it ends with a good discussion on how to stage military scenarios and subplots, which I also liked.
I like one of those too. Like it gets into, you know, how to keep your players engaged and how to make a wartime plot like taking a hill. kind of thing. Like, how do you build that as a scenario? And it gives you some examples there, which I think is really, really cool. All right, you ready to get into our Warfront soldiers?
Let's go for it.
So this section is 19 pages long. You've got tons of World War II heroes. And here I'm going to go through them very quickly. And any of them that we have commentary on, we can jump in there. Plus, it's got some Axis World War II bad guys as well. Now, there's also commentary on each one of these entries written as evaluations by commanding. So rather than a superhero or whatever, again, this is the wartime guys. So they're out in one of the theaters. You know, they're either in the European theater, the Pacific theater, whatever. So commanding officers are writing the evaluations, or perhaps other Warfront heroes, or in some cases, even FDR himself. And one of the things I like in the stats here, and I didn't notice this till last night or very late, that they give you name, rank, and serial number, which is exactly what in every movie they tell you, you know, yeah, that's what you need to know. So I love that. That's really great. First up is, under the Allied soldiers, we've got the Blackhawks. Now, I'm not going to go into this person by person, but pretty much all the major characters that have been in Black Hawk comics are statted out with little pictures by Howard Chaykin, with the exception of one particular character of note. Who's that?
Lady Blackhawk, sadly non-pictured, yes.
Completely unfair.
Unfair, but I'm glad she's in here. There have been actually many Lady Blackhawks in the Black Hawk comics, but, you know, the main one. I'm surprised that Roosevelt would write the eval here, because the Blackhawks aren't even an American unit. It's an international unit run by a Polish guy.
Good point. Interesting.
Yeah, there are other weird assignments in here. One of them is like Sergeant Rock evaluates the Haunted Tank, and then Jeb Stuart of the Haunted Tank evaluates the Rock. They probably met in a comic somewhere, and that gave them that idea. But so the evals, normally, like, who do these guys interact with that could write an evaluation, right? So they had fun with that.
You get the Boy Commandos. You get the Creature Commandos. So these are the JMD Mateus' creations. You know, you get your vampire, you get your werewolf, you get your Medusa, all those different characters. We Frankenstein, which are lots of fun. And now we're just in a HBO Max cartoon, if I understand correctly,
yes.
Which I think is supposed to be pretty fun. Then you get into Easy Company. So this is Sergeant Rock. Now, interesting enough, Rock is not listed here.
No.
He's a little later, but you've got all of Easy Company. You've got your obvious ones like Bulldozer and things like that, but then there's a million other ones here. I'm not going to go through them all. There's a ton of them here. The only thing I will say, though, is that they are missing one. They are missing Flower. And the only reason I mention this is because, as far as I'm concerned, at least, that's the most high-profile death that Easy Company ever had, because it happened in Crisis on Infinite Earths number 3.
I mean, Flower is in here in the sense that they have a sidebar that says, look, we can't stab them all up. So here's a bunch, and they name them all, you know, killed in action, wounded in action. There's like long lists. There's a lot of Easy Company stories. And then they have stats for the typical Easy veteran. So Flower is probably those stats, you know.
True. I did look through that entire list of names to see if Flower is mentioned. No, he's not. But I do like, as far as the ones that are still alive versus the killed in action, it says still alive as of August 14th, 1944.
Right.
So, I mean, they're very, very specific. Okay. Then we get into G.I. Robot and his dog Jake, which is fun. Then we get Gravedigger, the Haunted Tank, and the folks from the Haunted Tank, which are great, including General Jeb Stuart, as well as the younger Jeb Stuart.
So we get the ghost, yeah.
Hunter's Hellcats, who I have no idea who they are.
They've got a Who's Who page.
Do they really?
It's the one where one of the soldiers is juggling grenades.
I must have covered it then, and I have no recollection of that whatsoever. Interesting. Funny how the mind plays tricks on you. Okay.
They're really kind of a Suicide Squad group.
Then we get into the losers, who I will name check because they're awesome. You know, Gunner, Johnny Cloud, Captain Storm, Sarge, and Pooch. Ona, who was someone that was added later to the group. Then you get Mademoiselle Marie. Then you get into the OSS and all of their operatives, including Control and all of their various operatives. Then you get an entry for Sergeant Rock, which is great. The Unknown Soldier, the Viking Commando, which always just cracks me up. I've never read a comic with the Viking Commando, but the whole idea is just ludicrous to me. But then you get a few Axis personalities from the Warfront side. Iron Major, Killer Shark, the White Lions, there's two of those, they're pilots, I wasn't familiar with them, and then you get stats for the typical Axis foot soldier. Then, because everyone demanded it, I guess, on page 112 of this book, you can in fact find stats for Adolf Hitler.
Well, we get FDR and we get Hitler.
I guess so.
But also it is going to tie in with some of the bunker, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
We
right.
need him, and I'll tell you why we need him later. I guess I got a couple questions this time.
All right, hit me.
Okay, first, imagine that your GM pitched a game where everyone was in the same DC-created unit.
All right.
Which unit would you like to play in?
Well, again, I had advance notice on this question as well. So this was a no-brainer. I knew immediately. It's the Haunted Tank, man. I mean, that is absolutely what I would play. I love the whole concept of the Haunted Tank. Probably would find some way to work around the Confederate piece of it nowadays. But either way, I love the concept of the Haunted Tank. Now, if I really had my druthers, though, I'd rather play a campaign of a bunch of weirdo soldiers with like weird, unusual skills on Dinosaur Island. That's what I'd really want to play. And that's, I know I'm peeking ahead to the next chapter, but I don't care. Like if you've ever read the War That Time Forgot, there's these guys, their brothers are all trapeze artists. And so they're like doing ridiculous trapeze things on vines, you know, in the War That Time Forgot on Dinosaur Island. That's the kind of crap I would love to play.
That's a perfect, you know, war comic from the 60s.
What about you?
You know, I love aerial action. So mm-hmm. I might lean towards the Blackhawks, but I also love spy stories. So I think my answer here is going to actually be the OSS.
That could be fun.
Let's imagine a different scenario where you played a sort of losers-like all-star war heroes game. You have to play a DC character. Which one of these soldiers would you play?
Folks, if you don't know, the losers did not come about fully formed. They were, if I remember correctly, they were all individual characters. Right.
Well, Gunner and Sarge were together with Pooch.
Okay.
And then but like Captain Storm and Johnny
was Clark. On his own. And yeah, they're basically the Avengers for the war characters. They had pre-existing adventures, and then someone later on brought them together into a team. Knowing that, I would sit here and go, okay, who would I want to play that's an existing character and pull together in this new losers type team? So my first answer would be, again, no question, is Lady Blackhawk. I mean, I realize I'm breaking up another existing team to put her on this one. I don't care. She's a great character. I love having her, you know, fly the missions, be the femme fatale and all that. I think Zinda would be amazing in that role. Second choice, though, if I couldn't have her for some reason, would be the Unknown Soldier. I love the whole disguise idea and acting like other people.
He's one of the big ones. You know, he lasted a long time and he had his own series.
What about you?
I mean, I have an unusual affection for Gravedigger. He has no real gimmick. He's just like really tough. And he's the kind of guy that gets, well, he gets buried and digs his way out. You know, he's just cool. And all the stories I've read of him, I felt had a lot of grit. And so I would play him.
Good choice. Like it.
Chapter 7?
Yeah, we're narrowing in towards the end of the book here, folks.
It's really the last chapter. We get some appendices. The last chapter is locations, 6 pages. Important wartime locations, such as the All-Star Squadron's headquarters in the Perisphere, Black Hawk Island, or as it is spelled here, Balcock Island.
Oh, geez. Is that another typo?
On the map, yeah. The map is...
Oh, gosh. There's a typo in the table of contents, too, that's pretty egregious, where it says Golden Age Heroes, but it's actually Golden Age Villains. So, you know, they needed Brenda Pope. That's what they needed. For those of you who know, you know.
Dinosaur Island. And even, you know, as we mentioned earlier, Hitler's secret bunker. But you got to have Dinosaur Island. That's clear.
Yes. Yes.
The War That Time Forgot is the most obvious plot you want to send your PCs through at some point.
Well, you know, I wonder if it is the most obvious or just the most obvious to us. Like maybe we're programmed weird.
Well, I am certainly programmed. I mean, I've role played a lot and with different games and different settings. And there's two basic classic RPG canon fodder. The basic villain is a Nazi. If your characters see a Nazi, they automatically know he's bad and automatically want to kill him.
Punch him in the face. Yeah. It is always okay to punch a Nazi in the face.
And the basic monster in games, which is cool, is the dinosaur. You can fit them in many more. You know, you don't have to invent anything. It's like people see dinosaurs. It's cool. Fighting dinosaurs is cool. Riding dinosaurs is cool. They both are perpetually exciting to me. And you'll note that in the Dinosaur Island section here, they have stats for dinosaurs. And King Kong is also statted out, or a King Kong-like
that is true.
Giant ape. At the same time, full marks for including Hitler's bunker as a kind of dungeon adventure so that you can at least reproduce the famous Captain America cover. I think that's why you need the Fuhrer in here. You need the bunker, and the bunker has like multiple levels. They've made it so it's like a little dungeon that you're going to go in at the end of the war. And if you're Captain America, you're going to punch his lights out. And if you're the Ghost Patrol, the Ghost Patrol didn't make it in this book.
Oh, Shame. Were they World War II?
Yes, they were World War II. They spent all their time pantsing Hitler and Mussolini.
Oh, that's right.
Stuff like that. Like they pranked the Fuhrer. That's one omission. Okay. If you're the Human Torch, I guess you kill Hitler at the end of the war. You need your bunker for those purposes. Let's end our campaign. let's send our heroes down there. Tell them what's what.
About Dinosaur Island, I love that you mentioned dinosaurs and Nazis, because I have often said the greatest villain to fight is zombie Nazis riding cybernetic dinosaurs. So, I mean, it just fits right in with everything you're describing. And you could even play that plot point in this game. It would be perfect.
I have also played zombie dinosaurs. Off to the appendices. Appendix A is weapons of war. You get stats for... my God, 5 pages of your typical vehicles you see in World War II, from jeeps to tanks to fighter jets and battleships and all of that. So also covered are weapons of the era, rifles, grenades, mortars. I mean, the best bit is the exotic weapons, right? The war wheel,
woo!
Which I love. Like guns and jeeps, boring. War wheel, awesome. You're forgiven, Sourcebook. But there's plenty more weird war machines, super assassins, that kind of tech that you could repurpose for any of your war heroes or mystery men superheroes.
If I was genuinely playing in the Warfront campaign, I would be poring over those pages trying to figure out what weapon and what model and everything to have. But as just a general reader of this book, that whole section is like, all I care about is the war wheel. Just give me more war wheel.
Yeah, for sure. And that leads us to our final appendix.
This is pretty cool. And actually, before I started reading the book, Siskoid pointed it out to me. So props to you for getting me so excited about this appendix. Appendix B, it's just 2 pages. It's called Gone But Not Forgotten. And they acknowledge in here that there are some significant characters who were erased in Crisis on Infinite Earths from World War II. So you get, here in this section, 4 characters. You get specifically their World War II, essentially Earth II, stats for Superman. As of Superman, and they specifically say these are his stats as of Superman number 1, which is 1939. So not Action Comics number 1, but Superman number 1. Then you get Batman and Robin as of Detective Comics number 50, which would put them about 1941. And then it says Wonder Woman as of All-Star Comics number 23, which would put her as stats as about 1944. I found that fascinating.
I have some questions there. I think there's another typo.
Oh, geez, another one? What do you got?
Well, first of all, sorry, yellow-gloved Aquaman, Green Arrow, Speedy, you know.
There is no Earth 2 Aquaman.
I do love this ode to Earth 2. Yeah, they start with the heroes already into their careers. Like, stuff has been established. So they're not saying it's not their first appearance. They have had time to evolve a little bit.
Which is the smart thing to do. Correct. Because you don't need to see Superman stats from his first appearance. You want him once they figured out who he is.
Totally. Yeah. So they start Batman with Robin. Detective Comics number 50, not Detective 27. Also, we don't need to perpetuate the Batman with a gun thing, you know, as a result.
Right.
Now, Wonder Woman has to be a mistake.
Okay, tell me why.
Well, she doesn't appear in All-Star Comics number 23.
Oh, crap.
And it's really late, 1944, later than most of these characters. So,
true.
So I think they mean All-Star number 13, which would be a typo, 23, 13, right? Because that's the issue where she's invited into the Justice Society.
Okay.
She doesn't score a connection to the JSA in the text, so I don't know.
How long had she been in publication at that point? Because she was, what, 1941, I think?
Yeah, I'm surprised it's just not an issue of Wonder Woman or an issue of Sensation Comics. Why is it a JS All-Star Comics?
That is strange.
She's not in number 23. That can't be right. All right. Sorry.
I do love this whole section. I mean, regardless of whether they got that number right or wrong, this whole section is glorious. I love seeing this. You've got a, what is that? Probably a Jerry Ordway, I would think. Yes. Superman there in the corner, which looks fantastic.
It's from Who's Who.
It's glorious. I love these pages. They bring me so much joy.
Right. And they're well written as well. The Batman and Robin, there's a little play there. You know, one night some 15 years ago and you got Wayne says, what's this? And the mugger responds, a stick up, buddy. So you get like the origin story, but as a little script.
You see who they're credited to.
Bob Kane. Well, Bob Kane.
Okay. It's credited at least to Bob Kane. Yes. And then the Superman section is credited to Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. And the Wonder Woman section is credited to Charles Moulton. So supposedly,
it's all text from the comics. Yeah.
Supposedly these are the words from these creators, which is great. That's awesome. Now, beyond this, you get an index, which, by the way, is amazing. You get this giant 3-page index, which is so helpful in finding characters. I absolutely love it.
That's the end.
That is the whole book, and it is absolutely beautiful.
What we usually do on this show, or all the role-playing shows, is how did we use it? Or have we used it, you know, in our Game Master or player careers? Personally, I always wanted to send our own heroes, trademark, back in time to play Blitzkrieg, the Blackhawks adventure. There's a first edition adventure just for the Blackhawks. So yep. I wanted to, I don't know, quantum leap them there in the heads of Blackhawks, or I don't know how I would have done it. And I never managed it. But I would have used this book to update everything to second edition, basically. I also ran a DC-centric Mutants and Masterminds campaign that had Rip Hunter using our heroes in the role of Booster Gold, you know, in the Booster Gold series.
Oh.
And we did go back to World War II. We fought like some sort of war machine in the first adventure, but I just never used this book to its fullest potential.
Sadly, me either. I never got to use this book in a campaign. I read it. I certainly wish to have used it. I played DC Heroes for a while, but I wasn't really the game master. I was more of a player. I would game master one or two adventures. But I guess you could say the closest I ever came to was in a Marvel campaign. So I played Marvel Superheroes with a bunch of friends. We played for like 5 years as a great group. And I did come up with a scenario to send our characters back to the Golden Age World War II adventure. Ultimately, I handed that plot off to, and it's sort of like you mentioned, like going back into the minds of other characters, what it was. But anyway, ultimately, I handed that plot off to another person in our group who was running the adventure at the time, Patrick, who was actually a past guest on Let's Roll. So Pat ran it, and we had a great time. It was a lot of fun. It was mostly dealing, though, again, with our own characters that we had created during the World War II era. So I would have loved to have done it with the DC Heroes, a World War II campaign, maybe sometime. I hope so. And who's not to say it could still happen.
We both played a game run by also past guest David Gallagher with Marvel Golden Age Heroes.
Oh, yeah.
Not long ago. But yeah, it's still not the same, right? So this remains a book that I like to pour through. I like to read little entries here and there from time to time, just pick it up and read it. It takes like a special group that wants to do this, that is interested in this era to actually, you know, run it as more than just a one-off.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find the correct players sometimes.
Well, even a one-off would be worth it, though.
Oh, sure. I mean,
or a short-run adventure, you know, maybe 2 or 3 sessions or something. Yeah.
At least let's go punch Hitler on an afternoon, you know? It's like somebody's missing. Oh, just like pick up this other game and let's go punch Hitler.
Exactly.
But I guess I got to ask, because this isn't just Let's Roll / Hero Points. It's also the JSA podcast. So how does this rate as JSA content for you?
I think it's absolutely phenomenal. As we said, it's not just JSA. It's, you know, it's technically wartime is what we're looking at, because it goes beyond. But as a fan of the JSA, as a fan of the sister team All-Star Squadron, folks, this is a glorious resource for you. If you're a fan of either one of those teams, if nothing else, just to flip through and, like, you know, look at, oh, what's Green Lantern's, you know, ring strength versus Starman's, you know, whatever you might want to look at. It's just fun to read. It's fun to play with. It's fun to just explore the book and have a great time. Unfortunately, it is very hard to find nowadays, you know, because it's a physical book that was printed in 1991. So there's not a lot of them out there. There are places to find digital copies of this. So, you know, maybe ask some friends if they know where to find one, if you have to. Maybe someone who's talking right now. Anyway, what about you, sir? How do you think this rates as far as JSA content goes?
To me, it doesn't stop at the JSA, right? It's I was an All-Star Squadron fan first.
Okay.
So, and all my favorite Golden Age characters are all basically All-Stars, but not JSAers necessarily. There's a lot more characters that aren't JSA members. But I do have my JSA favorites, obviously, and they're in here. All but Black Canary, who I can probably figure out how, you know, from the modern Black Canary and other, you know, other books. I just love this era. So JSA, Freedom Fighter, whatever, even Young All-Star. Look, I won't discriminate. I'm just glad they're all in one book, and a book that is fun to read and interesting and informative when it comes to the war stuff. And I do love war comics.
Mm-hmm.
So that second section as well, which has nothing to do with the JSA, obviously, is still fun to me, interesting to me. It's one of the gems in my collection.
Reading this, you talk about war comics being fun. Reading this last night inspired me. I went back and read some old Haunted Tank stories. So just to get a flavor for how those stories were back in the day. So lots of fun. So good. And you mentioned All-Star Squadron, different from JSA. I know they are, you know, definitively they are separate organizations, but in my mind, they're really just one big organization, because the JSA is a subset of the All-Star Squadron, and Roy Thomas wanted to write the Justice Society. And so that's the way I see it. I see it as just one really big team. I think what we need to do at this point, Siskoid, is take a quick podcast promo break, don't you?
Okay, here they come.
A long time ago, in a comic book rack far, far away, during the years between The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, Marvel Comics kept the Star Wars magic alive, delivering bold new stories, expanding the mythology, and taking our favorite heroes and villains on unforgettable adventures. Now join me, the irredeemable Shag, and an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we journey back to this incredible era. We begin with a comic adaptation of The Empire Strikes Back and continue through the thrilling tales leading up to Return of the Jedi. If you're a seasoned Star Wars veteran who knows your Shira Bree from your hoojibs, or a brave explorer venturing into these comics for the first time, this is your hyperspace lane to classic Star Wars adventure. Join us for Marvel Star Wars, From Empire to Jedi, every other month on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
So which is the hottest Marvel character?
Iron Man.
Ant-Man. I can't decide between Professor X and Magneto, so both.
Loki.
Is Wolverine Marvel?
What about White Tiger?
What about White Tiger?
Doc Samson.
Doc who?
Star Fox.
That's a video game.
The girls go on a journey to determine every Marvel character's hotness in Ohotmu or Not, the official handbook of the Marvel Universe podcast you didn't know you wanted. Available on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
All right, we're back from break. We're just going to wrap things up here. This has been an absolute blast. And Siskoid and I are planning to, I hope, do another one of these next year or the year after during the JSA in the 2000s era. What do you say, buddy?
You know where I live, unfortunately.
That is true. So, folks, now come back next month to the JSA in the 90s podcast, where we are going to present another spotlight episode. So in December, we'll be spotlighting two JSA-related comics from the 1990s that focus on the holiday season. And I'll be joined by two fantastic guests to help me cover those issues. Who will they be? Come on, people. You know how this works, most probably. You'll just have to wait and find out next episode.
And you can watch for more role-playing content on this feed in the coming year. I have no plans at this point, no concrete plans for what we might cover. But if you're coming in from the JSA podcast, you might want to check out Let's Roll. There's a lot of stuff with me and Chagan.
There's a lot of great DC stuff in here, whether I'm on it or not. There's a lot of great role-playing discussions. It's a super fun podcast. It is absolutely worth listening to. So, and just to help explain, we call this Hero Points because it's specific to DC, but the whole thread is called Let's Roll. So definitely check that out. That's going to do it, folks.
Yeah. Until then, I'm Siskoid.
And I'm Shag. And we're asking you to join the fight.
For justice and Let's Roll.